Thank you for coming. I know everybody, not I know you, and such as you others will be coming now. Who is Adidasa Maharaj? What's his teaching? Why are people going to the centers all over the world and joining his way? His way is called the Radical Reality Way of Adidham, or the Radical Reality Way of the Heart. Why is it called that? What's unique about his teaching? There's so many things that are unique about his teaching, but maybe a couple that really stand out to me are that because of his fullest realization, the way begins with the recognition of divine reality, the condition of existence itself. Not as a goal, but at the beginning. And also the way is not about seeking in any form. Hopefully today we'll tell some stories that can help you find the answers to all those questions. Before I begin, I want to read a couple of things that Adidas said. The happening of truth itself is another matter altogether, another kind of event altogether. It is not through the mind. Truth itself is at the heart. Truth itself is not a proposition argued over against another proposition. Truth itself is self-evident on the face of it, because the heart authenticates it in the moment of reception. And Adidas says, has always said, when you hear and feel the truth, you know it. He continues, that is how everything right must happen. The dialogue method only creates more talk, more play of opposites. Self-declaration of truth itself is the only approach that works relative to truth. Truth itself is simply self-revealed. That is how I work. It is self-evidently the case. And Adidas also said, I do not operate by giving my devotee a method to realize oneness with real God. It is a hopeless task. It is not my devotee who through effort recognizes or realizes non-separateness from God. Rather, it is I who live my devotee as non-separate from real God, from my own divine self-nature, self-condition, and self-state. And my living of my devotee becomes spontaneous knowledge of me in my devotee. I first transform my devotee, then my devotee begins to realize what has happened. That very process must be enabled, wherein the divine can enact oneness with the devotee. And then the devotee, depending on the degree of his or her intelligence, sooner or later realizes that that is the case. And that is how the principle of devotion works. Often we see videos of Adidasa Maharaj, and he's looking at the devotees in front of him. And from the separative ego point of view, we might think he's looking at me and my qualities and me and you and all that. But that's not what he's saying. He meditates his devotee. He realizes the non-separateness. He recognizes the non-separateness of his devotee. So when he's turning to us, he's turning to not a separate entity, but to our true condition of non-separate reality, divine unity. A unique gift that has basically been unheard of in the tradition of mankind. So I'm going to tell some stories. They're called leelas because a leela means the play of the guru with his devotees. Well, these are the play of the divine avatar with his devotees. So these are quite profound and very wonderful, heartbreaking stories. I'll talk about 40 minutes or so, and then we'll show a short 13-minute video that helps explain a little more about his teaching is, and a little more of a feeling of what he feels like, physical form. And then I'll come back and talk about some more stories, and then we'll do some questions and answers. And we'll get out of here by midnight, 1 in the morning, some reasonable time. On April 25th, 1972, in a little storefront on Melrose Avenue in Hollywood, California, Franklin Jones opened his first ashram center. About 30 or 40 people were invited. He came out and sat for about 40 minutes. He kept his eyes closed so we didn't have to have those in the room could look at him and feel him rather than having a little awkwardness with eye contact. And then he spoke and actually addressed one of the people in the room that was kind of questioning his authority to be speaking. At the end of the event, most of the people left. Those that had already responded to him stayed and wanted to have more contact with him. It became clear to Ari Da, or to Franklin Jones at the time, that he's going to have to continue doing what he had been doing by submitting to us, by submitting to those that are coming to him, by coming to us in our day-to-day, ordinary circumstances, and allowing us to feel his freedom and his happiness while we're dealing with what we deal with in our ordinary, struggling, and complicated lives. And through that attraction to his free state, we'd be drawn to find out more about him and drawn into his company and become his students and disciples and devotees and establish the ashram as devotees. So I have a lot of stories about how he did that and what difference that made in our lives. But then he said, once you begin to recognize my divine condition, my free state, and it attracts you, then you're going to start responding to me with gratitude and devotion and love and all this hot responsiveness. He says, at that point, you'll start coming to me with your devotion, and I will start submitting to you. I took a long time to understand why that transition was so important, and that became clear to me recently at a retreat. While he was coming to us, we had a certain degree of familiarity with him. And that familiarity allowed him to be an other, and also allowed us to be kind of protected, because we now had knowledge or something about him. But when we started, our devotion started developing, and he stopped coming to us, we came to him in devotion, in his state of conscious light, love, bliss, reality, is felt and known, you can't have a familiarity with that. Because if you're apart from it, you can't be familiar with it. And if you are the same as it, realized in his company, then there's no separation to have a familiarity. So it breaks the opportunity of that subtle detail that we all got into. So we'll begin by the stories of how he came to us in our ordinary circumstances and revealed his freedom. I started in a Jewish family, and I was bar mitzvah and went to Hebrew school and followed the tradition and had a belief in a greater reality, God. But it didn't open my heart. It didn't answer my questions about where is truth? Where is happiness? Is there something greater about existence itself? Wasn't there. So then in the 60s and the hippie times and all the accessories with psychedelics and drugs of different sorts, expansive consciousness would happen a little bit, and then I started hearing things more about the Eastern philosophies. In the West, it's like, if it's Jewish, it's for chayim, it means for life. Live it fully. And if it's Christian, it's you sin, and you've got to be reborn, life, heaven and hell, and all these other forms. But in the East, it's about the ego is an illusion. Transcend it. the Beatles got involved with transcendental meditation. Maybe that's where happiness is. So I got involved in it too. I got a mantra, initiated, let's got some words, and I would sit home and say these words. First, I say them louder and quieter and quieter and quieter. And after 6 months, every day doing that, I found that I could concentrate. I could relax distractions. The mind would come up, the body would come up, and just focus, allow me that concentration. But it didn't answer my questions about where's true happiness? Where is there a God? You know, is this God a belief, or is God in a real living relationship? A friend gave me a book called The Autobiography of a Yogi by Paramahansa Yogananda. I was very impressed because Yogananda was having all sorts of wonderful spiritual experiences. And those spiritual experiences were taking him out of conditional reality, out of the place where there's money, food, and sex for fulfillments and consolations and indulgences and all that, into great profound awarenesses, revelations, and different points of view. And then I was invited to go to Northern California to a place called Ananda. One of Yogananda's devotees, Swami Kriyananda, had started it up in the woods. And I went there, and everybody's dressed in white. And the men had long beards and long hair, and they all talked very soft. And the ladies were really pretty, dressed in white, with long hair. Everybody was looking natural. No one had any makeup on, but they all looked bright. And it was clear that there wasn't a lot of conflict going on. There wasn't a lot of competition. There wasn't a lot of self-righteous, all sorts of stuff that the world is used to up there. It really impressed me. So I joined up. And I started studying Yogananda's teaching, and I got initiated into Kriya Yoga and started getting the spiritual experiences, not the ones he got, but some. And they would take me out of my point of view. And I studied his teaching for 3 years until I decided I wanted to be part of that community up there. I wanted to dress in white, let my hair grow, and talk soft. And get whatever else I could out of it, right? So I moved up there, and I set up a teepee. Actually, everyone had some tents. I set up a teepee in the woods. Indian style. I think it'd be a little cool. But the first night it snowed. The second night it snowed. And the third night it snowed, so I couldn't handle it being in a teepee, not knowing how to heat that thing. So I'd go back to the hut where the food was served, and there's a heater. And after 3 days, I said to Swami Kriyananda, "What's with the weather?" And he said, "This is Northern California. It snows here." I said, "Well, when's it going to stop?" He said, "In the springtime." Oh, okay. So I said, very practical. I said, "I'm going to go down to Los Angeles and do some things. I'll come back in the springtime and start my renunciate life." Big eyebrow goes up like, "You think that's how to start a renunciate life?" He said, "Never leave the master." I said, "No, I've been with the master, I'm initiated." So I went down to Los Angeles. That's the end of my story. Now, this is background, and I'll show you why it fits in. I went to my brother's place, I had dinner, and I called a friend, and we talked about what's our life all about, what's our gurus all about, what's our realization all about. And then he said, "What are you doing tomorrow?" I said, "Oh, I'm waiting for springtime." He said, "I'd like you to meet this guy. His name is Franklin Jones." I said, "You want me to meet somebody called Franklin Jones? We're talking about spiritual things, right?" And I was with Maharishi Mahesh Yogi, and then I was with Paramahansa Yogananda. And up in Ananda, there's all these swamis all over the place. Why do I want to meet somebody called Franklin Jones? He goes, "He's a good man. He has good energy." I said, "Okay." We decided to meet in the morning. I said to my brother in the morning, "I'll be back for dinner." And I left to go down to Melrose Avenue, Hollywood, California. Didn't know what it was going to be. I found out later, but it was going to be at the beginning of the first ashram in the middle of Hollywood, California. Why? Hollywood represents show business and entertainment and look at me. And a lot of competition. It's kind of ego land. We all are, but that's kind of a little exaggerated place. He wanted to set his ashram up in the middle of it. Right? I didn't know it yet, so I went inside the room, met my friend. There were a couple people painting in the ceiling. There were drop cloths on the floor, and the whole place had been renovated. Didn't know what it had been and what it's going to be, really. The smell of fresh air, fresh paint in the air. And we're talking for a few minutes, and then the front door opens, and a man walks in, Franklin Jones, with two ladies, Pat Morley and Nina Davis. The second I looked at him, I felt something that overwhelmed my being. There was this absolute, what it felt like at the time was a rush of happiness. And I couldn't make any sense out of why am I feeling so absolutely happy to see this person. At the time, in my limited awareness, sensitivity, I watched him as he walked around the room. And I felt, I think we went to high school together. And that's why I'm so happy to see him again, because the feeling was like somebody who was my best friend and I hadn't seen him for 30 years. And there he is again. Hi, you know? In mature practice and growing in practice, I began to understand that Adida is enlightened. The enlightened being doesn't hold any defenses or protections from his actual state. And his actual state is love, bliss. His state radiates from his being. So the state, his state of love, bliss, which is the true state of everyone, awakened my heart immediately without any words spoken. And my heart opened. And I became love, bliss. The very first contact with Adida without a word spoken was he revealed who, what he is and what I am. Not I separately, but the truth of reality. So I watched him in the room, and as soon as I was getting the opportunity to meet him, we were introduced, and my very first words were going to be Bright and High, 1958, right? But he, after we said hello, he said, what are you doing? He didn't speak superficially. His words had a depth of feeling to them that it made me feel like I should answer what my life's all about, not just why am I standing here. So instead of Bright and High, I just answered the question about, well, I have a guru, because all I know is he's a good man with good energy. I have a guru in Northern California. His name is Paramahansa Yogananda. And I'm down here waiting for the springtime. And then I'm going to go up and live there. He said, well, that's nice. What are you doing tonight? I said, nothing special. You see, there was no ashram. There were no formalities. When he walked in the door, I'll elaborate a little more about that. His hair was kind of long and combed back. He was wearing a V-neck sweater, a dark beige sweater with no shirt underneath. Bare chest. He had lighted drawstring comfortable pants on and some sandals with no socks. And he looked very comfortable, and he was with two very attractive ladies. To me, it was a sign of a guy from Hollywood. There was nothing spiritually significant about what he looked like. And yet, he completely opened my heart by his presence. So he said, a few of us are going to get together tonight. You should come. I said, well, was that just kind of a social invitation, or should I actually come? So I said, should I really come? He said, yeah, you should come. Yeah, that's okay. Immediately I knew that we hadn't gone to high school together. And I still didn't know why. Not only did I feel so happy to see him, but I also liked him already. There's something just straight about him, you know? He talked to some other people and he left. I talked to my friend a little bit and then went back to my friend's house and met his wife and his child and had some dinner there and talked a lot about who Franklin Jones is. And then it was time to go to the next occasion. So my friend and his wife and I went to the next occasion. When we got there, there were seven others there. Franklin called everybody his friends in those days. There were seven other friends with my friend and his wife and myself. A total of 10 friends were approaching Adida in early February or middle of February 1972. We said hello to each other. A little social time. And Arida came in. As soon as he came in, he took a seat and said hello to everybody and smiled. And then I figured I'm going to find out why I like him and why I felt so good. But the very first thing he said was, and he's saying it to you right now in this room as well, have you ever noticed that everyone is always seeking happiness? Have you noticed that you are always seeking happiness? What does he mean by that? And he said, have you ever changed your life circumstances because what you were doing didn't continue to have the happiness in it that it originally had? Did you change a relationship? Did you change a job? Did you change a location where you were living? Or major things like that? Have you made changes to get that happiness that you didn't feel any longer? I went, absolutely, in all cases. But my attitude was, but everybody does that. That's what life's all about. But he said, you should have gotten the lesson that you're seeking happiness because you're not recognizing your true state, which is already happy. I had never heard that one before, my true state that's already happy. And he said, but when you do turn to something for happiness, have you noticed that it doesn't last? Check it out. It changes. A silly example. What's your favorite flavor of ice cream?
And chocolate chip.
Everyone says chocolate. Chocolate chip. Okay. I give you a great big jumbo scoop of chocolate chip ice cream, right? And you go, I really am happy. Huh? I give you the second scoop of chocolate chip ice cream. More happy, happy, right? By the fifth scoop, no way. Don't want it. No more taste. No more interest. I'm bull and bloated. No. Well, that's a silly expression. But it changed. Something made the happiness. And he said, look at everything. It changes because happiness that we feel glimpses of in things is not in the things themselves. The happiness that we feel glimpses of is in our own actual divine condition of conscious light, our own divine condition of divine reality, which is loveless, which is absolute unqualified happiness. That is our true state. We get a glimpse of it here and there and there. But we try to hold on to it there. It's not there. So it shows you that if you really want that happiness that you're turning to all the time, go to the source where it is. It is our own true condition. I don't know about you in the room, but my feeling were, wow, no one ever spoke to me so clear about my feelings, so direct in my needs and what my search has been all about. And yes, I would like to go to that place. How do I get there? And he said, that is when divine grace comes into the picture. Divine grace allows an avatar, an enlightened being, to appear in this conditional realm. The avatar is living the free state, the unqualified condition of loveless, the condition of conscious light, as Arida calls it. And being in his company, it's transmitted from his being. It just flows from his being and it attracts others. And that is the way to find your true happiness, through the attraction, not through the accomplishment, through searching, seeking. Now he's sitting as close as I am next to Peter, and I was feeling really happy that night. And it wasn't just because of what he said and it made so much sense and he was talking though directly to my need and my feelings and my heart. But there's something else happening. This free state of his enlightened state was affecting this being and opening my feelings into vulnerability and attraction and happiness. After a while, he talked about a couple things and then he left. As soon as he left, I turned to everybody in the room and I said, I got to apologize to you all about tonight. I said, why? I said, He was talking to me so intimately, so directly, so personally, all night long. Every time he wanted to turn his eyes to someone else, I held his eyes so he wouldn't leave me. They all started laughing. They said, that's how he does it. All of us, we all do the exact same thing. There's something unique about Franklin Jones. He can make contact with you at a feeling depth and then make contact with every single other person at the same feeling depth and never leave you. And we're thinking, that's weird. But it's profoundly wonderful, right? And he could do that for all beings forever. We all hugged for this unusual opportunity to be in his company and what he was saying about where happiness is and the truth of reality. And then I left with my friend and went back to his house. We talked all night long. So the second contact with Arida was a profound communication and a feeling of his freedom, of his happiness. A kind of a continuation from what happened in the morning. I slept on his couch that night, and then I figured, I'm going back to that place on Melrose Avenue, Ashram, Melrose Avenue, and see if Franklin's going to come there. So I got there early. There were a couple other people were in the room. And somebody said to me, are you waiting for Franklin to come? I said, yeah, I am. He said, well, could you help? We're preparing this to be his center, an ashram. I went, oh, okay, I got it. Now I understand, sure. And said, here's a paintbrush. There's a wall here, and it has a wooden trellis on the top of it. And could you please go up and paint that wooden trellis? It's a big meditation hall. The wall separated the meditation hall from a back room. I said, sure, I could do that. So I take the paintbrush, I climb up the ladder, and I look through the trellis, because it's all open, and I can see Arida of Franklin Jones' desk is right there on the other side of the wall. So I figured, if he comes, I can check him out. I can kind of figure out why he said everything he said, why I feel everything I feel in his company, make sense of it, you know, keep in control, get on top of it, and stay protected, like all egos do. So I get up and start painting. I didn't know there's a principle that happens in the company of an enlightened being. There's an intensity that generates from their being. And if you're open and vulnerable or just simply receptive, he enters you and opens your heart more fully, as what happened in the morning yesterday. But if you're contracted and self-protected and, you know, manipulating and strategic, like trying to figure out who he is and what he's all about and all that, right? Then it magnifies your self-contraction. It magnifies your negativity, your self-meditation. He took his seat. He started working a little bit. And I'm painting. But after a little while, I started feeling, my God, this is going to take me days to get this thing done. What am I doing here? I'm supposed to be on vacation. I'm supposed to be with Yogananda. I should be at the beach right now. What am I doing up on this ladder painting? And like I said, just I don't know what's going on. There's an intensity coming over my feeling being. I just relax. A little later, I'm feeling, I'm only like, 3 feet above the ground, right? 4 feet above the ground the most. I'm looking down, and I'm so unstable on this ladder, I'm going to fall off it, I'm going to break my neck. And it was all, everything was exaggerated. It was actually exaggerated. Emotional, visual, physical. And then at one point, after a little later on, I understood. Oh, I got it. Everything he said last night about happiness and God and truth and prior state and all that, he made it all up just so I could come here and paint this trellis work for him today. And it actually made a logical sense to me. The mind is really wacko. I don't know what's going on. I have a tendency to complete what I start, so just complete the job. You said you wanted to help. Stop thinking. I want to leave several more times and do the whole time, through this whole time, I never made a comment, a grunt, or a moan about the difficulty I was going through, the ordeal that it was all about, until the very last stroke of brush. The very last stroke, when I was finished with it, I made a great big sigh of relief. Phew! Immediately, from the back room, at Arida's desk, Arida broke up with this huge laughter. It was the most beautiful, intimate, feeling sound I have ever heard up until that time. It wasn't just laughter. It was feeling generated in that laughter. And there were words in the laughter without them being spoken. And the words were, I know you are having a hard time up on the ladder painting that lattice. I know you wanted to leave several times. And I went, how could he possibly know what I was feeling? He said, and I thank you very much for not leaving and completing the job. And his laughter was so infectious, I started laughing with him. And his words came further in his laughter, and you're invited to stay. The entire teaching of Adidham was given, the essence of Adidham was given, on that very first day of service without a word spoken. I was self-contracted. I was self-involved in my problem, my uncomfortable condition. He laughs. His laughter drew my attention until I'm laughing with him, feeling him in his freedom, and completely forgot about my whole self-contracted state. See, that's the way he's offering. I offer a relationship, not a technique. The relationship is the attraction to his freedom. And that attraction to freedom draws the heart and weakens and minimizes and reduces the consolations and indulgences and everything else we're living to try to fulfill this separative self-sense. So the third contact with Arida was a full communication and an invitation to stay there. Every day, go back to my friend's house, slept on the couch, slept on the floor, slept standing up, just to be there, talking more about Franklin Jones, and go back to the ashram. And his desk, Adidas, Franklin's desk was in the back room, and he would invite his friends to come and sit with him. Because he was now inviting us into his company so that he can show us more qualities of his enlightened state that would attract our heart to want to be in his state, to be awakened to his very state. And one time he would talk about the ordeal he went through as a child, the ordeal of growing up, the humorous situations, the difficult situations, the unusual situations. And it was just like us hanging out together, just talking, friends talking. And just sitting in his company, listening to the stories, we would relax. And we really get to like him. Not only love and all the other things, just get to like him. He's developing the relationship. Right? And he would tell us stories about one time he went out into the field and there was a beautiful looking cow out there. And he wanted to go pat the cow. And when he got really close to the cow, he started snorting and started scraping its feet. And it was actually a bull. So he's turned and he started running away and the bull started charging after him. He just made it to the fence, over the fence before, the bull would have really hurt him. Other times he's riding a horse and the horse didn't want him on his back. And he's going towards the stable and the doorway to the stable is very low. And the horse knew that if he rushed through that doorway, he'll knock Franklin off his back. And Franklin had to swing on underneath the neck of the horse to get on through the doorway. And other stories, like one day he asked his mother, are there any desserts today? She said, well, I made tapioca pudding. And he said, oh, where? And she gave him the pot of tapioca pudding off the stove, and he was so excited, he started dancing around with his tapioca pudding, all excited, yelling, tapioca pudding, excited, and then he slipped. And the whole pot of tapioca flew up in the air and splattered all over the floor, and he slipped, and he fell on the floor in the tapioca pudding, roaring with laughter, and his mother was standing right next to him, roaring with laughter. And she said to me personally, that was the happiest day of her life. She never felt such freedom of happiness. And then other stories of growing up and what deals with them. They were just interesting stories of this person, the God-man person. Other days he would say stories about his love for his teachers and his gurus. And it was really impressive how he honored them so profoundly. He talked how great that his realization was actually greater than theirs. But he just worshiped them with all the greatest men that could ever be, and everything they did and who they are. And he would cry with this love he had for his gurus. And it was unique to us because he was so vulnerable. He was so expressive. He was so showing of his love that it brought a depth of feeling that we were not that familiar with. Again, revealing his states. Another time, in Melrose Avenue back room, he said, "Tell me your stories. Tell me the tragedies of your life. Tell me the ordeals that you went through that broke your heart and you actually never healed from it. You just blocked it and protected it." Right? We said, "Oh, no, no. No, no, no. We don't want to tell you those stories." He goes, "No, you're with me now. Tell me these stories." So we would start telling him our stories, and something very unique happened. If I tell you a story, you listen to the story and you respond. As we were telling him our stories, he was living the stories with us at the same time that we were telling them. And we had the feeling that these were not our stories any longer. They were his stories as well. Because as we got emotional, at the same time, he would get emotional. And as we cried with the tragedy, he would be crying at the same time. And there was something about the feeling of it wasn't our unique tragedy, because now he was living it with us, that softened the uniqueness of our solo part about it. And then he said things like, "The reason you received the tragedy the way you received it was because where you were at the time. But you could have received it a whole different way." And not just in words, but in feeling, bringing us into the feeling of a whole different way. He showed us how we could have received the tragedy in a less negative way. And it wasn't like just thinking something or accepting something. It actually was feeling how that was acceptable. And then he'd say, "But give it all to me. Give your suffering, give your tragedies, give your ordeals, give your heartbreaks to me. And I will eat it up and spit it out and bring love into your heart." And that's exactly what he did. We would walk out of the Melrose Avenue ashram back room feeling free of ordeals of lifetimes. Yeah? Brightened at the heart, happier in the footstep, breath flowing naturally. Refreshed, absolutely. Yeah? I always felt that of all the temples in the world, the Melrose Avenue ashram back room was one of the greatest of all, because it was human, it was transformative, and there was no formalities or other things that make it more complicated. The ashram had not even opened yet. Now, I realized, it's about 2.5-3 weeks since I came, I told my brother I would be back for dinner on the first day. And I completely forgot about everything. There's a tradition of Krishna and the gopis. The gopis are out in the field, taking care of their cattle. And this blue man walks across playing a flute. And it wasn't the color and it wasn't the flute. It was his radiant state of freedom. And they felt that. And they were drawn to be with him. And rather than leaving everything, they actually left their tendencies, is what Arida explains. Their indulgences, their consolations, their addictions, their tendencies were left to be in this free condition with this being. And I thought it was a great fairy tale. It happened to me. I came in, he opened my heart, and he kept showing me happiness, showing me to understanding, right? Revealing his state, I want nothing to do with anything else but be in his company. And just to talk about him every night. I completely forgot about my brother. I forgot about Yogananda. I forgot I had a teepee up in the bush, up in the woods. I just wanted to be there. When it hit me, I went, whoa, it's been a loka, a conscious condition that took me out of my ordinary point of view. And there was nothing more wonderful and liberating and magnificent about it than being in his company. So now springtime's coming, and I'm supposed to go back to Ananda. So I had to really seriously figure out what I wanted to do. Because there's a tradition when you accept the guru is going to offend you. He's going to disturb you so your ego, your self-defenses, and all your righteousness can come up, right? And then he can work with that. But if he really offends you and you're not committed, you're going to leave, right? When it gets difficult. So I knew that you don't leave your guru. So I knew there was one thing, I had to stay with Yogananda. And then I had to try to evaluate, okay, what's Yogananda's teaching? What's Aridaya's teaching? Franklin's teaching? Well, Yogananda's teaching is about spiritual experiences. This is started in the Vedas and the Upanishads, ancient Hindu traditions. But it comes down to spiritual experiences. And I was having some of those spiritual experiences because I had been initiated into some of those practices. And they do take you out of the body. And they do show you a different state of consciousness. And they do show you the limitations of the conditional point of view. And they were profound. And the ancient traditions are behind it. And then Aridaya, or Franklin's teaching, was that the limitation with spiritual experiences are that the one that had the experience comes back to the one that had the experience. The point of view comes back to the point of view of separative identity, the separate self-sense, who had the experience. And then that separative identity, that separate point of view, that I, that had the outstanding experience, wants another. So spiritual experiences become a seeking process. And when you have a spiritual experience, you want to hold on to that experience. And Aridaya was saying, his teaching is the understanding where suffering starts from. It starts from adding the act of separation, adding the sense of identity of I, me, my, on top of our true condition of divine reality. Adding that separate self-sense is separation from divine reality, and he calls it a self-contraction. So it's contrary to Yogananda's point of view. And it was really clearly communicating to me that what Franklin was saying is so right on. But again, how do I make a decision? And then I just said, what does my heart say? I have to be with Franklin. I love him. He's fabulous. He's magnificent. So I went to him and I said, I don't want to go back to Yogananda. I want to be with you if you accept me. He said, that's good. What are you going to do with your teepee and things up in the mountains? I said, well, I can go up there Friday and I'll come back Monday. And he said, oh, well, I was planning on opening the ashram while you would be gone, which means taking on devotees, awakening devotees to a culture of enlightened beings who can move into the world and bring his light of their own true condition to all beings, liberate all beings from suffering, seeking, and death, because it's the ego that dies, consciousness doesn't die. He goes, but you won't be here, so it'd be good for you to be here, so I'll wait until you come back. Now, at the time, I didn't know the big picture of it all, but at the time I felt, what a sweet gesture. He's going to start his business, but I'll wait until I come back. Did you ever have something you have to do that's important? Not about liberating all mankind, but even not show or presentation or something. When you're ready, you want to go for it, right? I'll wait until you come back. So I figured, I made the right choice. And he said, it's a relationship that he's offering. So many times, every time, confirming how it's a relationship. It's not a belief. It's not a technique to do. It's a living, hot relationship. Does that heat it up? So I want to tell another Leela, because it will be about when we did recognize him and we're growing in our recognition of him, and now he wasn't coming to us, we were coming to him in devotion, and how that expanded the devotion. I was sitting on the floor in the Melrose Avenue ashram in the meditation hall on the carpet, looking at his photograph, his Murti, in the front of the room, and feeling a hot happiness that I stayed with him, that didn't go to Yogananda. Just looking at him and just feeling happy to be there. He came in the side door, he saw me on the floor, and he came and he sat right next to me on the floor. I could feel his shoulder leaning against my right shoulder. And I felt so happy that he'd come into the room and made that contact, and even just to see him again, right? And I turned to him and I just wanted to praise him. I didn't have the words. I had something of the feeling, but I didn't have the words altogether. So I started talking about, Franklin, we really want to let you know how much we all appreciate what you're doing. It's really great, and thanks a lot. And it's like I was talking to a social worker or something, or a Red Cross worker out in the field or something like that. Not a divine avatar who's opening the heart to truth. He didn't give me much time to speak, because after two or three words, he just simply turned his face in front of my face that close, which is about, 10 inches away. And I looked into his eyes, and the pupils of his eyes started getting larger, and not his eyeballs, the pupils got larger and larger. It was overwhelmingly beautiful. It was overwhelmingly full of the depth of feeling of vulnerability. No protection, no defense, pure vulnerability. Tears started pouring out of my head, out of my eyes. And what does vulnerability, unprotected being feel like? It's love. You take away all the defenses, all the protections, the true state is love bliss, and that's what came through. And so the sense of overwhelming love was radiating through his eyes. And after a while, the sense of separation fell apart. There was not any he that I was looking at. There was just a sense of a condition of love. And it wasn't, wow. It was absolutely ordinary and absolutely bliss as a condition of existence, not as a high. There was no separation, and there was only love bliss. And that's what he showed me every single time. There is no separation, and there's only love bliss. And it lasted. It still lasts. When I turn to Adida, his Murti, and I turn with an open heart and allow him to just give his gift rather than me trying to get something, he reveals there's no separation and love bliss is the condition of existence. After a while, tears are pouring down my face. On their own. I mean, I didn't cause the tears, but also wasn't even aware of them. But then he said, you should see what you look like. And then he gave me a great big hug. And I fell into his arms in that hug. It was like perfect freedom. It was like just natural happiness. I became his devotee that day. Everything prior to that day was love, attraction, interest, everything else. But he revealed to me that day that he is not the man as a body-mind separate being. He is his enlightened state, and his enlightened state is conscious light. And conscious light is felt as loveless. And there's no separation in it. He revealed that's who he is. And he revealed that is who I am also. And that is who the condition of existence is, what the condition of existence is. All things and beings. It changed the recognition. It allowed devotion to actually be a response rather than an effort or a trying or something. We're drawn in Bhagavan's company. It's a feeling matter. As soon as we have a moment to break from it, we go back into the mind and become social and leave the feeling being. There was a comment made in the video that I wanted to make earlier that everything that Aridat did in direct contact with every single one of his devotees was not just for the person he did it with. It was to establish his divine state, his spiritual transmission in this realm for all time. So all the answers to all the questions are given, to all the books are all given, so there's the understanding, and his spiritual presence is alive. And what he did in the feelers that I've been telling you were just to establish what he does for everybody. And we continue then. We moved from Los Angeles to the Mountain of Retention Sanctuary in Northern California. And one day I was invited to go to Arida's residence called the Manor of Flowers early in the morning. And as I was walking there, three other devotees were also walking there at the same time. And we didn't know why we were being invited to his home. We came into the living room and we're invited. He said, Aridar is in the sunroom, which is a side room with a big sun's light. And he was relaxing on a lounge. And as he entered, he was reading a newspaper. And we bowed and offered a gift, a flower at his feet. And then one of the attendants said, and there's a table right here, four chairs around it, sit at the table. Aridar looked at us and smiled and went back to reading the newspaper. After about 5 or 10 minutes, tea was served to the four of us. And it was completely clear that we were just invited to be in his company. Informal company. He was reading a newspaper. Sometimes somebody came in and gave him a cold drink or wiped his brow. And it was amazing what happened to the ego point of view by just coming into his company. Whole social personality fell away. There was no need to talk about anything at all. The feeling of the room, the feeling of his company was just still. Without quality. Still. Natural. The mind quieted. The mind quieted. Aridat said, the reason the mind is so busy is because the mind is always trying to figure it out, to understand it, to make sense out of it, to get on top of it, to be in the free state. And it can't get there because it's doing, its own point of view is preventing it to get to a free state because it's separate to begin with. But the mind stopped in his company. And there was nothing formal about it. He was reading a newspaper, laying on the lounge, and we're sitting next to him. We drank the tea. We didn't even look at each other. Just looking at him. We could have stayed there forever. After an hour, we're asked to leave. Every day for a week, for an entire week, we're invited to do the exact same thing. Come into his company while he's sunbathing in the lounge, and feel his presence. At the end of the week, I felt it was a profound initiation it was a showing about how his, if you, relaxing into his company, just being there, receiving his presence, and the whole being is transformed by it. The seeking stops, the mind stops, the breath relaxes. I felt it was like I became a member of his family. I felt that intimate because it was a kind of situation that ordinary devotees wouldn't be involved in that, but be that close to him during that kind of natural situation. And this is what he gives everybody. This is what his state does right now, all the time. We move to Aridasa Marajashram in Fiji. And there was a gathering at the Himshtami one evening, many evenings, but one particular evening. And I got a phone call that my father was just rushed to the hospital with a heart attack. Somebody told Arida that my father just rushed to the hospital. Arida asked me to come forward, and he said to me, "Tell me about your father." And I tell stories about my father. He says, "Let me feel your love for your father." And I didn't have a great loving relationship with my father. He didn't want to be a parent. He did not know how to be a father and didn't want anything to do with it. So he just found ways of being a politician and doing other things to get away from the house. So I didn't have a father per se that would really do that thing, right? But I could find qualities about him that were great. So I tell beloved about the greatness of this man, the importance of this man, what he's done for society and what he did in politics and other things, right? And I never kept saying, "Cry for your father. He's having a very difficult time right now. He needs to feel your love." If you ever question whether our love felt for somebody is actually felt or not, no question about it. He's having a very difficult time in the hospital with a heart attack. He needs to feel your love. And I would tell him about my love for my father and find the love for my father. And others would come around me and they'd hug me and they'd tell me about how their mother died or their father died and the ordeal they went through and how they had to show their love for both parents. And it went on for quite a long time until it was so much, I just had to go to the back of the room. I forgot to say that my folks used to live in Boston. And I was living on the island. I asked my mother one time by phone, "What do you do for entertainment in Florida?" And she said, "The thing we like to do most is go to the beach, sit on a bench, and watch the passing parade." A little poetic, but that's how she'd like to speak. In the middle of this situation, my father's in the hospital dying of a heart attack, telling my beloved guru about my love for my father. I had to go to the back of the room, and there was a bench there. I sat on the wooden bench in the back. Arida came and sat next to me on the bench. 50 or 60 devotees in the room, because there had been a gathering. And after a couple of minutes, he said to me, "Isn't it interesting sitting on this bench watching the passing parade?" Had he said, "I'm taking care of your father," I would say, "I hope you are and believe it as much as I can." But when he actually spoke words that I never told him, I'd never uttered those words because there was no reason to say it. He spoke the words that my mother even said to me, which revealed that he completely knows what my relationship is all about with them. I just looked at him and cried. The next night, I was in the men's dormitory, sleeping. In the middle of the night, I was awakened. In ashram, in Aridasamarajashram, everyone called me by the formal name that Arida gave me, Gerald, which is my born name. My family never called me that. They called me Jerry, my nickname. In the middle of the night, my father's voice speaks loudly, "Jerry, deep, strong voice, and I wake up. The feeling that he was in the room was undeniable. It wasn't just his voice. The feeling that he was there was undeniable. And then as we speak to discarnate entities when we do purification pujas, let them move on to the destiny, I spoke to my father saying that you died, but it's not so bad, is it? You're still conscious. You can feel me, you can hear me. And you're moving now on to your destiny. And thank you for coming here. Adida brought you here so you could feel his place. So you could feel that he is taking care of you. And that I'm with him also. And I love you. And after a short time, feeling changed. He had left. And there's no question about it that he had died the night before, but he actually did come that night. And it was Adida's blessings, not only of taking care of him, but also serving me, about letting me know that he was taking care of him. There's a place at Adida Samarajashram that he really liked to go to called Banyan Bay. It's a bay, the ocean outside there, beautiful bay, tropical, flowers all over the place, and warm breezes, and there's frogs and turtles and little fishes in the waters. And we set up a cabana, a little tent for him, and a lounge for him to lay on, relax on. And I was invited to serve him many times, and this one time I was there to serve him to keep his body cool and to keep the bugs off his body, because it's tropics, there are bugs. So I stand up and I will be fanning him. And he just relaxed, laying on his lounge. A bug came, I'd shoo the bug away. Just keep fanning him. And it was so wonderful to just serve somebody in a not simple way because of your love and because you know it's helping them, it's keeping bugs off of them, keeping their body cool. It's just such a gesture of love. And he rolled over and he took a nap at one point. Serving. And after a good long while, he actually rolled over again and got up and walked to the beach. A devotee that was also there said to me, "It's been over 2 hours. You've been in samadhi." And all I could say was, spiritual state, samadhi. All I could say was, "Oh, is that what that was?" Because there was nothing special about it. It was the most natural tree condition. I had no sense that I was standing there. I had no sense that he was there. The body was doing its service on its own. There was no sense of separation at all. And the condition was love bliss. Once again, there was no separation. And the condition of reality is love bliss, constantly revealing that same thing every time. I always thought samadhi was an experience. True samadhi is without experience. Which brings us to another lila that I want to tell, which might be the last lila. It's less, we go into questions and answers, and then you want to ask me some more then. At Adida Samarajashram, there's a hall called the Silver Hall. The Silver Hall is a place where Adida would sit with devotees and do his transmission work, which meant that it wasn't that we just visualized, got the sighting of him in darshan of him, but he actually was working with the body minds of his devotees. How can he do that? Because he's not separate than us. He is the life force in these body minds. So, in order to go into that hall and allow him to do the work that he would do, you have to have recognized him to the degree of searchless beholding, which means that you're not trying to find him. You've already recognized that he is here. You're not seeking him. And you behold him. So you come into the hall and you simply receive and allow whatever he wants to do to be done. And don't try to do anything at all. And that's a practice. Well, Arida had died 4 months previous to this time. So in April, our brother in... In March of 2009, I went into the Silver Hall. His Murti was at the front. I took my seat, and immediately I felt that I was not prepared to be there. I was still thinking about what project I was working on before I came in. And the body felt kind of uncomfortable and awkward. And I figured, I have to leave. But I know that you're not supposed to leave the Silver Hall. No one ever left the Silver Hall. I go, how can I get around that? Because I got to get out of here. And then I understood. I was self-contracted, self-identified with my limit. And by my tendencies, rather than surrendering in place, I want to go work on it so I can come back. I went, just surrender. So I sat up. I took a deep breath. I looked at his murti, and grace transformed everything. His divine state completely transformed the entire condition of awareness. Immediately, the sense of self-identity wasn't there. There was no sense of a me, my awareness, me, at all. And at the same time, a heaviness is kind of just falling off the body. And the heaviness obviously felt like life and ordeal and struggling and hurts and pains and dying and death. All the ordeals that we carry were just falling off the body. And the energy started flowing down the front and up the back and down the front in this absolutely natural state of equanimity. Completely happy, natural state of equanimity and no sense of conflict or any kind of sense of contraction at all. I have said that we are not separative entities. The ego is an activity that we do. And actually what we are is we're modifications of conscious energy or conscious light. We're modifications of conscious energy. As awareness moved around the room, it wasn't my point of view, it was just awareness. Moved around the room, everything looked exactly as it looks right now. There were no glows, there were no halos, there were no gold beams, there were no bright lights, there were no... Everything looked exactly as it does right now. Except that the feeling was that there was no separation. At all. Every modification of conscious energy was conscious in a condition of consciousness. And so there was never, as awareness looked at another form of energy, it was perfectly known as being conscious energy. The history of the karma and the life and all that ego stuff is not important. Conscious energy is what we are. And that's the answer to all the questions. So everything was absolutely, perfectly known as conscious energy. There's a practice called the perfect knowledge practice. That is perfect knowledge. The ego has created two things. One is called time and one is called space. Traditionally, it's acknowledged that ego, that there is ego identifies time and space. Well, as awareness was in this conscious condition, there was no such thing as space because there was nothing separate. Every form of conscious energy in the bodily form was the same as the form of the walls and the air between us and the lights and everything was all the same, a condition of consciousness in form called energy. There's no such thing as space. There's no, because there's no me and you, there's no here and there, no this and that. It was one divine unity. Arida wrote a book called Not Two Is Peace. I always thought that that meant you and I get together, we get really, you know, get real close, and we go out and try to save the world. You know? We're not two, we're going to work as a team, right? The conscious condition, there's not two. There is only reality. Unqualified, non-separate, one state. Consciousness itself. So there can't be any conflict in it, because there's no way to have a conflict there. There's only one condition. So when he's talking about not two is peace, he's talking about the enlightened state. And then time. As awareness would look at a modification of conscious energy, the form of this object, which is a person, right? It was perfectly known, and not only by your present moment, but your entire history was revealed in the present moment. Everything that brought you to the present moment is part of you. Evolution, incarnation, relations, loves, hates, pains, was part of you. And it suggested where you're moving. Not like an insight of where you're going to be, but suggestion. It's like this image that we see is just the front edge of everything that ever brought us to this. And it's continuing to move on. So time doesn't have past, present, and future in it. Time's a continuum. We call it this moment and that moment. No, that's the ego saying me and my. It's a continuum. And no limits, no stopping. From Arida used to say, I bless people who died. I mean, how can you bless someone who's dead? Because every single relationship that was in our life, this life, past life, other lives, is part of the present moment. It's what brought you here. And by looking at you, he feels everything, and he can bless your entire past generations and incarnations. Make complete sense. It was a complete free gift of no separation. And the feeling was love, bliss. Once again, the same state. But this state was recognized as what's called the witness consciousness. And there are traditions there are some traditions that basically understand the witness consciousness and speak about it. Arida has spoken about it. Interesting thing was, there was nothing special about it. It was the most natural, ordinary condition. And absolute divine revelation. So there's no such thing as space or time. They're an illusion that the ego creates. In fact, there's a perfect divine unity of non-separate oneness. And the awareness in the occasion was completely natural. Not high, not a special, but completely natural. And the feeling was absolute love, bliss, equanimity, balance, harmony. Bhagavan's presence was fully felt. And he revealed what divine reality actually is as consciousness and light, a conscious light. After about an hour, devotees started bowing. And as I started moving to bow, immediately a sense of separative identity came back with it was my awareness. Rather than just consciousness being self-aware, it was my awareness. And as I was bowing to the floor, this heaviness came over the body again, this sense of concern and struggle and suffering and seeking and dying and all of that just came over the body again. I bowed to Bhagavan in deepest gratitude, and then I left with everybody, and as we walked from the silver hall to the outer courtyard, where there was another occasion just around the corner, I was bewildered. How could I have been involved in the most profound divine revelation as a free gift, and yet it didn't change me in any way at all? every single time I've ever come into Beloved's company and I felt his presence, either my heart would open or understanding would happen or a depth of recognition or a sense of presence or also the feeling of my limitations or my inabilities or my refusals. But something was always revealed. And in this case, as I'm walking to the next event, I felt exactly the same as I felt before I came into the Silver Hall. Everything that happened in the Silver Hall did not affect me at all. And how could that be? It made no sense at all. Until I finally sat down just around the corner at the outer courtyard, and I understood. When I sat up in the chair, took a deep breath, and turned to Bhagavan Smriti, his divine presence replaced me. I was transcended. I was removed entirely. And then everything that was revealed was consciousness, self-aware. Witness consciousness was the condition. And so I wasn't changed, because now as an ego, self-identified again, I'm trying to feel how I was changed by it. Well, I, as an ego, was not changed by it. So then my next feeling was, okay, well, I can see that that was a pure gift. How do I get back to it then? Because it was absolutely perfect. And it was clear that I was transcended, I was removed, in order for the divine revelation to be revealed. So I can't get back there, and nothing I can do from the point of view of separation can get back there. Actually, the separation is what prevented it. So all I can do then is turn to Bhagavan in devotion and heart response and conform this life to his calling and instructions and allow him to simply do what he will do when he would choose to do it. So that I recognize there's no possibility to get there by seeking. Seeking can't work. The proof of seeking doesn't work was obviously, again, obvious. So I wasn't there, and I can't get back there, and it didn't affect me at all. Well, then the last question was, how can I talk about it? How can I speak to you right now and tell you exactly everything that happened in detail during the divine revelation of the witness consciousness in the Silver Hall, and I wasn't present. I wasn't having the experience. It's because we are consciousness. We say it's my awareness and my this and my that. It's not. We are consciousness. We add the self-identity on top of it. I was in the room. I was transcended. Witness consciousness was revealed, and I completely can speak about it perfectly because we are all consciousness itself. And the ego act is just something added on top. It's a very profound consideration to really feel into, because it was so clear to me that being completely aware of everything that happened, it was not my awareness. It was consciousness self-aware. And the communication is from that same place. It's a profound gift from the divine avatar, Haridasa Maharaj. And the offering that he's willing to give all beings and all devotees when we resort to him and allow him to do, to give the gift that he wants to give. And bow at his holy feet and thank him for his divine presence and gift of love. Da.